When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Brothers, sisters, siblings, welcome to Penn's Sunday School, starring Penn Jillette. This is a special episode recorded from Penn's home in Las Vegas. On today's show, Penn is visiting the Terrible Lizards podcast with Izzy Lawrence and Dave Hone. They'll be talking with Penn about big dinosaurs, big numbers, and people who follow bad science. Here he is, preaching fossils. It's Izzy Lawrence.
Penn.
Yes.
Yay! Gosh, it's been a while.
Long time.
I'm always so surprised every time I see a photo of you these days of how slim you look. It's amazing.
Well, I'm even slimmer now. I've been kind of focusing very seriously on that. So.
Well, it's very good, very handsome. This is Dave. This is my friend Dave, who is a
hello. Lovely to meet
Dave.
You.
Dave, how are you? Hi. My name is Penn.
I know. Thanks to Izzy, I started watching you when you were on Channel 4 in the UK in something like about 88. So
that would have been a little later than that, but yeah,
okay.
Early days, yeah. So
maybe
yeah.
Not too much later. Maybe you're right and I'm wrong.
Yeah, definitely early 90s at the latest. So yeah,
yes.
within a couple of years of that, give or take.
Cool.
I'll take that. So yeah, lovely to meet you.
Well, thanks very much for doing this. Do you know what we're going to do here? Have you got a question ready?
I know you and I know dinosaurs, and I can really? Probably think up a question.
Excellent. So let me just, what I'll do is, I'll instead of embarrassing you now by fangirling all over you, I'll fangirl all over you as an introduction in the podcast and just introduce you straight onto it. And basically,
we all need someone we can fangirl over, and you can fangirl all over me.
Oh, brilliant.
To borrow from Mick Jagger.
Excellent. Well, what is your background with dinosaurs? Were you ever a dinosaur fan? Are you a dinosaur fan? Do you like them?
I think I have just the general modern point of view of dinosaurs, which is... You know, had that wonder and that awe and that feeling of smallness that comes when you first learn about them as a child, and learned most of my information from the Flintstones about dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And hated Jurassic Park, loathed it.
Did you? That's interesting.
Oh, yeah,
why?
Piece of shit. I just that usual empty popcorn jive. And I didn't think it had, you know, then you have Spielberg's crazy thing of, well, you know, it'll inspire more paleontologists. Listen, Steve, we already have too many paleontologists.
I'd agree with that.
That is not a career to go into. That's not where you want. Why didn't it teach people to want to be plumbers? That would be useful.
That's very practical.
I also thought the special effects were lousy.
Really?
Didn't think it looked good. Didn't give me the proper sense of wonder. What dinosaurs are, think about dinosaurs, the joy of it to me is, for it to expand our view of ourselves in the universe and in time. And Jurassic Park strove to do the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Is strove to take dinosaurs and make them smaller, make them just characters in a drama that took place in months, whereas dinosaurs, to me, are supposed to move our drama to 200 million years, you know, expand it out. It was like, you know, taking the idea of the universe and bringing it down to human terms. I don't want to see dinosaurs on human terms. I want to see humans on dinosaur terms. I think that's more profound, more poetic, richer, deeper. And so I didn't like it. I'm not a my love of monster movies and horror is not things that are bigger. It's things that are smaller. I don't find Godzilla and King Kong very scary. I find the misfits of the Zanuck misfits, not Zanuck. The Outer Limits that has a little ant-like alien monsters. That's what scares me.
Okay, so you
find that's because I'm a big guy.
Yeah. Well, not compared to most dinosaurs, you're not, I'm afraid to say.
Most dinosaurs?
Most dinosaurs.
Yeah. Most?
Most.
Most dinosaurs are bigger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've always had the image there were a lot of little dinosaurs cavorting around as well.
So there were, but they're still heavily skewed towards big things. This was actually basically the first thing I did for my research as a master's student and later published and I've worked on since. And there is a line actually in Jurassic Park, the book, which I cannot find an attribution.
Oh, you
for.
And your books.
I know. I think Crichton made it up. And there's a line where he says, where someone says, oh, most dinosaurs were actually the size of a sheep or a cow. That's nonsense. They weren't at all.
Really?
Most
now,
dinosaurs
that's not, of course, you've thought about this because you're the expert, but that's not just the fossil record confusing us. That's actually the truth.
No, and that's something I worked on a few years ago with a colleague of mine is trying to look at some of those biases. Because you're absolutely right. Small things don't preserve as well, and then they're harder for us to find. So you've got a double penalty, which takes small things out of the fossil record and makes bigger things.
Yeah, that's how moss gets
more preponderant. You know, there's a greater preponderance of larger things. But once you even factor that in, you still find that. So what we did in that analysis is we looked at the distribution of fossil mammals and the distribution of body sizes and the distribution of modern mammals. And you can see there's this big gap off the side where all the little mice aren't appearing because for all those reasons. But if you do the kind of same thing with dinosaurs, the dinosaurs are already extremely different from mammals. So even the fossil ones. So even if you added in tons and tons and tons of tiny ones, there's basically such a colossal gap that would have to be exaggerated like 5 or 10 times over to be true. And there's no particular reason to think that the fossil record and the way it forms has changed dramatically in that time.
Now, you're talking about individuals or species?
Well, sort of both. Small individuals of large species. So, you know, juveniles, babies are going to be much smaller. And actually juveniles are
But I mean the little dinosaurs, once you got one species of the smallest dinosaur, were there the same number of that species as there were the number of the big species?
Whew, now, that's the kind of thing we can't easily reconstruct, and it's very contentious. But
there
certainly,
you go, smarty pants scientist.
but that's also part of it. So yeah, you're right. If you have very big species, if you have Diplodocus, Brachiosaurus, all that kind of stuff, probably most individuals were much smaller than the big adults, which are the ones we're familiar with. You know, if you go down to Florida and go out looking for alligators, you will see the occasional 4 meter monster and you'll see plenty that are kind of 2 to 3 meters.
No, but that's not my question.
Mostly what you see is tiny ones.
That's not my question.
Okay.
My question is, you have mice and you have elephants.
Yep.
Okay. Now suppose there are elephants, tigers, bears, all these big things. There's three of those different species, elephants, tigers, and bears. Right. And there's only one species of vole. But you've got a million vole, and each of the lions and tigers and bears, oh my, you have only 100,000 of that species.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm asking. Were there the numbers of mice size, the smallest dinosaurs, not juveniles, full-grown, was that number greater than the number? For instance, it seems to me like we have more mosquitoes than we have moose.
Yeah, generally, yes. I'll give you that one, yeah. I haven't counted, but probably.
I believe the phrase here is biomass. Is that correct? No,
not exactly.
Okay. We're talking about population.
Because biomass would be the weight.
Oh, yeah.
I'm talking about the numbers. Yeah. Look over there. There's 150 mosquitoes. And oh, fuck, there's a bear. Let's run.
Yeah. I would run from the mosquitoes because they are a bane for me. And
I know they're the most dangerous animal. I know that. You're the one who gets your information from fucking novels.
But I have a bugbear with the mosquito as the most dangerous animal in Africa, because it's the Plasmodium parasite, which is the thing that's killing everyone. The mosquitoes are just transporting it around. But that's another thing. But going back to your actual question,
now Trump.
Yeah.
Helped by the coronavirus.
Yes, most dangerous animal.
You say mosquito is very funny. How do you say mosquito?
Mosquito.
Okay. I thought you said, what's that?
Mosquito. We say toe.
Mosquito. Yeah. Okay, let's not get into aluminum. Go ahead.
Oh, we could talk about aluminum and aluminium and how aluminum is the correct original spelling, which was then changed later.
Okay, I like you.
So technically the Americans used the original terminology, but it was changed to aluminium because aluminum was different to everything else. But it means you're now in this weird position where you spell it aluminium but pronounce it aluminum. But anyway, going back to the actual question.
We can also get into nuclear.
Oh, yeah, that one really annoys me.
The more educated you are, the less apt you are to pronounce it correctly. Nobel Prize winners in nuclear medicine have pronounced it nuclear.
Really?
And so it's a very, very odd thing, because the more learned you are, the less likely you are to pronounce the word correctly. It's one of the only examples of that.
Yeah,
and they think the reason is that people who work with it daily, like Jimmy Carter, who worked on a nuclear submarine, and I hate to say this, but George W. Bush, who had a great deal of study, are more apt to pronounce it wrong because they say the word nuke so much. That is the explanation.
So because they say it all the time, they use the abbreviation, and then that
slop of
bastardizes the
And I would like to ask you, what has that got to do with dinosaurs?
Not much at the moment.
You've got the Godzilla link.
I can try and put that in. So going back to your question, were there more, did small species have higher populations than big species?
That's the way to ask that question.
Great. Probably, but hard to say, because for that exact problem, that because we have these biases that stop us having lots of small things, they tend to be very, very rare. There are exceptions. So famously, the fossil beds in China, for example, where all these feathered dinosaurs come from, there's huge biases there in the opposite direction, and they preserve tons and tons of small things and very few big things. And then suddenly you find these things in absolute profusion, and they are in colossal numbers. But again, you've then got one set where they're almost absent and another set where they're super common, both of which are probably biases from the fossil record. So which is the correct answer? And the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. But equally, the really big ones, because they're throwing out hundreds of offspring, big things like Diplodocus might have been laying 100, 200 eggs in a breeding season if they laid multiple nests, which is perfectly plausible. And so actually, if they're flooding the environment with hundreds of babies, although they'd be very vulnerable to predators and a lot of them get eaten quickly, you can have actually really quite a high population. Just lots of them were very small. It's very different to what mammals do. Whereas you see an elephant and it's either big, or even a baby elephant is already a very big animal. These guys aren't doing that. And so you'd have lots more small individuals of big species. And I suspect those two might actually cancel each other out a fair bit. And so actually big species could end up having, in broad terms, fairly similar populations to even much smaller species.
So you're saying that dinosaurs grew more during their life than mammals?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at mammals, and actually even most birds, simply because most birds aren't very big in the grand scheme of things, the average baby at newborn, whether that's hatched out of an egg or given birth from a mammal, is a fairly hefty percentage of the size of mum. And then they grow very, very quickly because if they're mammals, we feed them milk. And if they're birds, they sit in a nest and mum and dad just cram food down them. Whereas dinosaurs in that context are much more like reptiles. You know, and you see those videos of, you know, sea turtles laying eggs, and they lay hundreds of eggs. So each of which is, you know, ping pong ball size for an animal which might weigh half a ton. And they're absolutely tiny, and they'll take 20, 30 years to get that size. So there's way, way, way more of them. They're very, very small, and they will take quite a long time to get up there.
So does that answer your question, Penn? Are you happy
with it? It does, but that wasn't my question.
Oh, okay, brilliant. Well, let's ask your question.
Was that the pre-question question?
My question was, let me get my...
quick time up.
spreadsheet. Yeah.
Okay.
What was the exact weight rolling. Of this particular raptor to the nearest gram?
I believe that most of our problems with people being religious and people being anti-science is simply and really comes down to this in my mind. Not being able to imagine big numbers.
Yeah.
I was just reading my friend Lawrence Krauss's book about the history of an atom. And he starts out by saying, you know, we have to imagine the entire universe the size of a baseball. That's where he starts.
Yeah, I was going to say, literally already.
Lawrence, we can't do that.
Yeah.
And I believe that human beings, in their imagination, can do about 200 or 300 years.
Yeah.
Maybe 5. And when you hear something like Cleopatra lived closer to the man on the moon than she did to the building of the pyramids, you go full ape shit. When you realize that humans have been around 200,000 years, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 years, and we've had agriculture for 10,000, you can't fit that in your mind. I can't. I have no way of doing that. And I believe that evolution is nonsense unless you can think of really big numbers. So with dinosaurs, you've got them gone about 65 million years ago.
Yep.
Spot on. And you've got humanoids maybe 6 million years. And you've got dinosaurs for, if I'm not wrong, like 150 million
years. From about 230 to 65. So now I'm trying to do the math. So 165-ish. So yeah, right around that.
And I know that when we say the word dinosaurs, it's like we're saying the word, you know, it's like we're saying the word mammals. There's a huge, broad, different kind. And I also think I know that there were many, many dying outs and risings.
Oh, yeah.
During
150
million
years. Absolutely. Yep.
What I wanted to know was what dinosaurs in that 150 million year window were the most successful in terms of being there the longest.
Oh, boy.
I have no sense of how long, you know, the T-Rexes and the others were around and how much, because we like what dinosaurs were walking around together. You know, if we went through a children's book of the, you know, top 20 most popular dinosaurs, how many of those overlapped? And my other question is, if we were to be at the time of dinosaurs and we walked out into a field or a forest, how many would we see? Would it be like squirrels or would it be like moose? And that is the question you almost answered.
Right. Well, there's about 4 there. Which group were the most successful? I'm having a quick think. I'd probably have to go for a group called the obviously you could pick a really big group and then that's just been around for absolutely ever. Cause if you make the group big enough, it's obviously overly encompassing. But in terms of a relatively narrow group, which hang around for a very long time, one called the Ceratosaurs. So plenty of people, it's not one of those classic top five that you get in every book, but Ceratosaurus. So it's a big carnivorous dinosaur. But it has a horn on the nose is the one thing everyone remembers. And that turns up in quite a few things as a result. More like a kind of platy spike. So rather than a rhinoceros like horn, something that's very flat and has another pair over the eyes. So that's Ceratosaurus. And then obviously,
oh yeah, I can picture that guy. Yeah.
There's a bigger group. So the Ceratosaurs evolved pretty early on. I think they're around in the early Jurassic, so one of the earliest periods, and their descendants at least go right the way to the end. They're clinging on near the end in a couple of southern continents. So they hang around in Madagascar, which was an island even then, and down in South America. Their descendants were a group called the specialist division of that's called the Abelisaurs, which are famous for having unbelievably tiny arms, even smaller than T-Rexes.
They're like nipples.
Tiny little,
they're ripple-like ridiculous.
Paddles. Yeah, they are utterly, utterly, utterly small. But that meant the Ceratosaurs had an extremely long...
So they would not be
long
able to pull your hair while fucking you.
No.
No. No, we can... Pretty safe on that one. So again, given some...
That should have been my only question. What dinosaurs could pull your hair while fucking...
Yeah. So that was the first question you asked. I'm trying to remember the second one. The third one you asked.
And how big are these spiky-nosed guys?
So the little ones are tiny. So I was part of a group in China that described one of, if not the smallest, and that guy was 2.5-3 meters long with the tail, so only kind of chest high to a human to the top of the head. The big ones were 10 meters long, you know, 3/4 of a ton in mass, really serious predators. Most of them were pretty big, actually. But there were a couple of small ones.
And it's carnivores that do the longest span, huh? That surprises me.
For that one group, it's one of those things where there's almost a little bit of randomness to it. So of course, to answer the question, who was around longest? You want to be one of the earliest groups and then just not go extinct. Right. And so, you know, there's half a dozen early groups and for whatever reason, they didn't go extinct when the others did. And maybe they just got lucky or maybe there was something special about them. But that they're not well known. We certainly the early Ceratosaurs do not have a great fossil record. So we don't know much about their origins. The one I described or helped describe, a thing called Limosaurus, so the mud lizard, because the ones we found were basically died in a mud pit, almost like quicksand.
Which is the way I intend to die, but that's not important.
I'll note that for future. But they were actually herbivorous. So they were it's a carnivorous branch, but there's a couple of these early divergents, and they were the earliest ones that we know of that flipped back to being herbivores, and they lost all their teeth.
Me too.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, don't lose your teeth. That doesn't make it harder for you. They got a beak, but they dropped all their teeth out.
I don't think they had potatoes then either. But,
probably, yeah. Now I'm trying to think
you
about
the
fossil record.
You don't have
to
work out fossil record of potatoes. It's fine. It's the same. We've got too many questions. Come on.
Yes. So. The third one was, if you walked out of a time machine, how many would you see? Probably quite a few. It's going to depend on where you go. You know, if you go to grasslands, even, you know, back 300 years before, you know, the buffalo had really taken a hammering, you know, buffalo were present in large numbers, but there's still going to be areas where they're less common. Whereas obviously there are bits like the Masai Mara Serengeti, even now in Africa where, yeah, it's just big animals, you know, every few hundred yards. It's really not, you know, yeah, you might go half an hour without seeing anything, but the odds are if you dropped into a random spot, you would probably see an elephant or a rhino or a giraffe or a dozen zebra or maybe a few hundred wildebeest. And there's no reason to think that the dinosaurs were any less numerous. In fact, there's some reason to think they were quite a lot more numerous because in some ways, some of the big ones were actually really efficient. And therefore, you can have more biomass of dinosaur than you could of mammal for the same amount of plant, which might actually make them quite a bit more numerous in some places. So potentially, yeah, you could walk out and easily see them. And I cannot remember what the middle of your three questions of your one question, the second round questions was.
I can't.
No, it was tied in with the one that you already answered about
how big a population. Yeah.
Hey, look at me all gussied up, huh? This is not the way I usually look doing Penn Sunday School. I got the working suit on. I got my hair all dyed. I got makeup on. I'm looking beautiful for you because we're running a bank show because I am spending today, Sunday, backstage in my dressing room because I am doing another season of Fool Us. But I'm taking this break to tell you about Masterclass. We did a masterclass. Penn and Teller did a masterclass teaching people how to do magic. And it has been fabulous. I mean, we had some nice ideas. We did a good job. We thought Johnny Thompson is in it. Matt Donnelly's in it. Pith the Magic Dragon's in it. And we really talk seriously about magic. But the great thing is what a great job Masterclass did. They did such a wonderful job of putting the whole thing together and making it really clear. There's a book with it that Handsome Jack helped us with. It's really, really good. With Masterclass, you can learn from the world's best minds and also from Penn and Teller. Anytime, anywhere, at your own pace, you can learn how to do magic from Penn and Teller. Improve your magic skills. You can do all of this stuff. It's really, really good. And when we were deciding to do it, I watched a bunch of them. Reddy Rich has gone through like dozens of them, and he loves them all, like Ron Howard, Steve Martin. You can learn from astronauts. Not that you're going to end up going to space, but maybe you would. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every masterclass. And as a Penn Sunday School listener, you get 15% off an annual membership. So go to masterclass.com/Penn. That's masterclass.com/Penn for 15% off Masterclass. There's great stuff. There's Tan France doing style for everyone. There's Brandon McMillan on dog training, Tony Hawk on skateboarding, Ron Finley, Chris Voss, kidnapping negotiator on how to just not how to not get kidnapped, but also how to do negotiation skills. It's a great way to learn something. It's really, really reasonable. You get a wide variety of topics. And once you buy one of them, you get all of them. So go to masterclass.com/Penn. Masterclass.com/Penn. And now, back to our bank show.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What is the nearest thing, if you were not allowed to speak, but could only point to an animal,
right?
What is the thing alive today that's closest to a dinosaur? Would it be alligator or would it be pigeon?
sort of pigeon, but not really, and equally sort of not alligator. So birds are the literal descendants of dinosaurs. So birds are dinosaurs. So that's one. But people often have this, there's almost a meme, but there's an idea that chickens are in some ways the closest to dinosaurs, and they're not. You've got this big branch for birds. Sorry, I'll start again. For birds that are still alive today, because obviously lots of bird species are extinct as well, you've basically got three big branches of bird evolution. One is things like ostriches. One is chickens and ducks and geese and turkeys and pheasants, and one is everything else. And so, of course, because of the way they branch out, you could argue that any of those three big branches is the nearest thing. But effectively, something that's close to the ancestor of ostriches and chickens, but of course that bird doesn't exist anymore. That was around probably 70 million years.
We also fucked up chickens so much. Chickens are not anything that ever...
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, cows and chickens we kind of created.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Indian jungle fowl in its true wild form is still pretty close to being a natural animal. It might be a feral domesticated version, but there are enough chicken species that live in environments like that, which look pretty close.
When I was in junior high, I asked a question that had
that's
been
very
answered,
dangerous.
had it been answered differently, I believe I would have gone into some form of the sciences as opposed to being a juggler. And that was, I asked about wild cows. Mm-hmm. I said, what are wild cows? What did we start with on our domestication of animals? And the teacher laughed at me and said, what do you mean? They're just cows.
Yeah.
Had that been answered, boy, that's an interesting question, Penn. Maybe you can spend the rest of your life asking it. Yeah. Then you would now be interviewing me as Penn, the cow expert, the person who knows more about wild cows than any other person on the planet.
The biggest rod.
Yeah. And that is a great. And
but now you're talking to someone who knows nothing.
Not I think we both know that's true. Not true.
but I'm really fascinated that the domestication of animals is essentially what gives us all our viral diseases.
Yeah.
Everything. With, you get, tuberculosis from cows. You get the colds from, horses, I believe. And of course, all your flus from ducks.
I'm trying to remember if it's, and this may be totally wrong and apocryphal. And I've just heard this because I haven't looked everything up and didn't know we were going down this route. I believe that, it's syphilis is a, venereal disease in llamas.
Wow. It certainly is for me. Those hot llamas, I can't resist them.
That's the one thing that will definitely survive this interview in the cut.
But,
back top of the episode, Penn announces. Yes.
It's very well known, and there's video available. It's not a scoop. Thank you.
Good. That, thank you so much.
But all my fascination with dinosaurs is strictly in time.
Mm.
Just
yeah.
trying to get that 6,165,000,000 balance together. Because if you can hold, I believe, if you train yourself, and I believe it takes decades, if you train yourself to be able to think in millions, I believe you can understand evolution.
Yeah, it's something.
If you can't, you're taking it on faith.
Yeah. My dad bugs me about this. He goes, how do you deal with the numbers? And I'm not sure I do. They've kind of become abstract to me because, yeah, as you say, even though I work on it, 148 million years versus 152 million years. They're both almost equally inconceivable, as is a 4 million year difference between them.
Yes. Huge difference. Yeah. And yet you just shrug it off.
Yeah.
I think we worked out at our very first episode, we tried to explain it. We said, well, if you take all the Harry Potter books, so that's 7 volumes, now how big they are, there's about just over 1 million words in all of them. So if each word is a year, then you have to imagine a shelves of Harry Potter books back in time with each entire, even the word A or Dumbledore is all 1 year. You can't deal with that amount of time. There's an interesting thing about the evolution thing. If you, I've recently read Tom Holland's book, Dominion, and that poses, it sort of shifts the reason why Christianity finds evolution so hard to grasp. It is that the idea of survival of the fittest, and that is directly against the Christian idea of the meek will inherit the earth. And it's that really riles them up and makes them fight against it, because they want to see God in nature, and nature's a bitch. And so,
but it's also because, and I argue with all my friends on this. My friend, Dr. Greger, who's an epidemiologist, I was just reading his book, and the verbs he chooses to use are wants, the virus wants this.
Yeah.
And, biologist friends use those terms, and that anthropomorphizing, I believe, drives people crazy.
Yeah.
Because evolution, the coronavirus does not want or need anything. It's just the one that happens to live is not even trying to live.
Yeah.
It's just that we know about it because it does live. And that sentence is the hardest thing for me to understand. The coronavirus is not mutating. It doesn't, you know, if it doesn't kill people, it's more successful. If it's longer being contagious before showing symptoms, it's more successful.
Yeah.
None of that has any plan or any idea. All of that is just, oh, well, that's what happens. And that thing you said was very, very important that I think is often forgotten when talking about evolution, in that the one that just happens to live.
Yeah.
And I have no sense of how much of that is chance. I can't do that on Microsoft and Apple and, you know, why Bill Gates was so successful.
Yeah.
If you talk to him, he will tell you, almost any successful, truly successful person will tell you there's a huge difference with luck, because Bill Gates knows personally and socializes with 36 people who are smarter, harder working, and less successful. He knows, and he knows they're smarter in every way. He's smart, and he knows they work harder, but he knows they're less successful. So he's flooded with that information to know that he's lucky. But that's the easy one, because we understand people.
Yeah.
The idea of understanding that a dinosaur at the early part of the dinosaur reign makes it through 160 million years because of luck. Once we've learned survival of the fittest, then we've got to go back and go, and oh, by the way, that's not true. They can also get lucky.
Yeah.
And you go, fuck you. Shut up. Shut up. I was just working on that, because the fittest always survive. We can kind of get our heads around.
Yeah.
But the idea that you've got to be successful and buy the lottery ticket that wins, both of those things simultaneously, and you have 100 million years to do it.
Yeah.
But you get to buy a ticket every day.
Yeah. But it also goes back to your point about big numbers, because the populations are often inconceivable. That's the other thing, you know. All right. You know, there's a million wildebeest. There's a million buffalo. Even those are giant numbers. But yeah, when you're talking about beetles or bacteria, which are in the trillions, then yeah, it's not too hard for one of them to win the lottery every day of the week. Cause
I'm reading the Lawrence Krauss book, and he has 10 to the 27th power. That's a number he's throwing at me.
Yeah.
And I write him an email and I go, Lawrence, you stupid motherfucker. Don't you realize that some people who dropped out of Greenfield Public High School are going to be reading this? Try to keep your numbers under 100.
Yeah. But it's like most people.
Well, you can have 100 to the 26.
Well, it's like most people when they hear about a billionaire, and they think, oh, millionaires and billionaires, forgetting that. You know, what's the difference between a millionaire and a billionaire? About $1 billion. That's basically, you know, it's a huge amount. The difference.
There was a horrible study that was done in the done with American school teachers who thought that million and billion were both just big numbers.
Mm.
And you know, you've got to say, you know. There was this wonderful chart. I can't do it off the top of my head, but 1 in 10 happens to you today.
Yeah.
1 in 100 happens to you this week. 1 in 1,000 happens to you in a year. 1 in 10,000 happens to someone you know.
Yeah.
1 in 100,000 happens to someone you've heard about. And 1 in 1,000,000 you never know about unless there's electronic media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We haven't even gotten over 1 in 1,000,000.
Yeah.
You know, and there's the other problem, which I think can sum up our political problems, which is we are kind of set to deal with about 300 people in our lives.
Yeah.
And that's- so that when we see someone pulling off someone's mask and hitting them with a club, part of our lizard brain thinks that's about 1 in 300 people are doing that.
Yeah. That's 1 in 150 is a Dunbar's number, 150. Dunbar's number is 150. So that's right. That's a lovely little study he did. So what he did is he hollowed out a load of primates' brains and worked out their brain volumes and then worked out the social group size they were in. So went from like, you know, little gibbons, macaques and that sort of thing, right, up to chimps. And then he just worked out, extrapolated from humans' brain volume, the amounts, the bigger the size of the tribe. And it is about 150. Give or take, yeah, depending on. And that.
So your tribe is 150 and you know about 300.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to relate to more than 150. Right. That's the idea.
Right.
So, which does also mean, though, if you work at it backwards, that the reason we have this big brain is to cope with a tribe that large, which is quite lovely if you think about it. All of this communication and intelligence that we have isn't so that we can go off and do amazing things and survive. It is actually so we can chat to everybody to keep our group together. That's why we need language. That's why we need to be able to put one thought in front of the other so we can keep this group of people we have together, because we can't groom everybody, because if we groomed everybody, it'd take 12 hours a day and we'd just die of starvation.
I've been trying to.
Have you? Yeah. Well done.
Groom everybody. Yes.
You do it very effectively.
That's one in each hand.
But I, you know, that's when I try to, when I, you know, I'm living in the United States now. Mm. So the, whatever outrage you and your friends are feeling, mine is by a factor of two, probably.
I'm sure.
And, it is incredible to try to remember that the outrage we're feeling is outsized. When you see the people in the Ozarks without masks, at a swimming pool, trying to remember that being 100 people is not a number in a population of 350 million. That's not a number.
Yeah.
That's not a number at all. It's not a percentage. It's nothing you can even think of. So these people doing stupid things that build the outrage is still this tiny, tiny, tiny number. The same as, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests. Yeah, people were looting and breaking into Targets and lighting fires. And the number of people that were doing that are the number of people that can speak Mandarin, Arabic, and English fluently without an accent.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not those individuals, though.
No,
you don't know that. It could be a thing. But there
so
we go.
When I think about dinosaurs, it's just more of me trying desperately to expand my ability to see numbers. You're working on the difference between 165 million and 170 million. I'm working on 150 to 151. That's what I'm pushing.
That's perfectly acceptable.
Can I fit Beyonce to the people I think about? That's my question.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much, Penn. That was amazing.
Thank you.
You're so sweet. And this makes up for it. Dave was explaining to me that he was having a dig in Utah and he was going to obviously fly into Las Vegas and he was going to go and see you and it had to be cancelled. So this makes up for it a little bit.
Supposed to be there about a month ago. So yeah, this was the... hoping to catch the show.
It's so they were doing in Utah.
Yeah,
was a place for paleontologists.
Oh yeah, so that Utah's really productive, and I've got a couple of friends who are in Los Angeles.
They're still proving that the gold tablets were.
There's a colleague of mine. I'd say even a friend of mine who is a Mormon dinosaur paleontologist, and he's an excellent dinosaur paleontologist, but I don't know quite how he squares his circles, but
yeah, well,
he's good at what he does and his research is fine.
I think all I try to remember is that I'm doing it too.
Yeah. We all have some cognitive dissonance with.
Oh, sure. Dissonance. I mean, I'm a libertarian living during a pandemic.
Yeah, I was gonna think worse than that. Yeah, it's difficult, Matt.
No,
yeah,
you have to rethink stuff, but it has to, you know, the way you do that is that the basic libertarian idea is as much freedom as you can have without hurting other people. Turns out that doesn't include not wearing a mask.
Yeah,
I can make the argument for not wearing seatbelts. I can't make the argument for driving drunk.
Yeah, because one's you and one's
those are two people. Profoundly different things.
Well, that neatens that argument up nicely in my head. Thank you. That's nice. Yeah, it's about not having other people. That's cool.
I don't have a right to not wear a mask.
Mm.
but I might have a right to have unprotected anal sex with someone who's HIV positive. I might have that right.
Yeah.
If there's consent all around. But I don't have a right to not wear a mask because that's not my choice.
Yeah. I think that's a fair thing. I wouldn't advise either. Just as a I wouldn't advise it, but yes. Anyway. Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Penn. And yeah, really appreciate it. It's really sweet
thank
of you.
You.
So we will hopefully stay healthy for us. Yeah.
I assume you people are being ridiculously safe.
British government is not
now,
good.
But yeah. As a university lecturer, we're not quite as bad as the US, but my university is talking about teaching classes again in the fall. And we're looking at that going, no, faculty, we'd rather not be in a room full of students that have come from all over the country and hang around harder for a couple of hours while they all face the front and breathe at me. That
it'll be harder to get the science people to do that.
Yeah, and we have epidemiologists in our department, so a bigger biologist, so which helps. But
this pandemic I found fascinating in that in every other huge disaster, the friends that I had that were experts were the ones preaching calm.
Yeah, and this is
after
that.
9/11. The yeah. military people I knew were going, there's not going to be another attack. There's not going to be a chemical attack. This was it. They wanted to blow up big buildings. They've done it. Calm the fuck down. They're not coming to the mall. Everyone who's dark skinned is not an enemy. Just calm down. This is the first disaster of my lifetime where the more people know, the more upset they are.
I think you're wrong about that. I have no way
to process that.
I think you're wrong about that. global warming people, climate people. They've been screaming for years now. and after seeing this, you're kind of like going, maybe we should listen to those guys a bit more.
And also the environmental part of, you know, if we're going to keep putting chickens by the millions feather deep in their own shit, we're going to keep getting viruses.
Yeah, you're going to keep getting problems. Yeah.
And one of the things that's wrong about this is that everybody's blaming the exotic foods, and they're not aware that that it is the common foods that are going to get us with the flu.
Yeah.
Which ties directly into climate change.
Yeah.
Because feeding our desire for meat and travel is a big part of climate change.
It is indeed. We should all just stick to potatoes. You proved that. So.
we can live on plants. We know that very well.
We can.
If you get your B12.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, thank you so
wonderful.
Much.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're a sweetie. Yay. Made our week. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Pleasure. Cheers.
That was great. And that was Penn Sunday School. Cha, cha, cha. Tune in again on Wednesday. We got another bank show for you, and it's The Big Think. It's going to be great. That was Penn Sunday School.
All right, I'm about to thank some Patreons here. Now, if I mispronounced your name, feel free to, one, either change the way your name is spelled phonetically in your Patreon page, or you can email me, Matt@HeyScoops, to get your name pronounced correctly on air. All right. I want to thank Ross Devereaux, Tony McElroy, Rue Dudley, Ryan Matthews, Jeff Baker, Jeff Peterson, Eric Doble, Elon Lee, Leah B., Jay McCulley, Kirill Varshavsky, Kelsey Johnson, Nicole Martin, Matthew Roche, Sarah, Brian and Michael Ladle, Steve Adams, XGD Falcon, Jamie Thrasher, Rachel Hawkins, Mark Smith, Katie Warren, Jake Schneider, Pete Hawk, Mark Hauser, and David. Thank you guys for supporting us on Patreon.
Hey, everybody, Jason Ellis here from the Jason Ellis Show podcast, reminding you that my podcast, new episodes every Wednesday, downloadable where all podcasts are available. Come see my friends, Michael and Kevin, as we talk to you about what's awesome, what sucks, fitness, fighting, parenting, life, spin kicks, LGBTQ community, how to defend yourself against the shark if it attacks you out of nowhere, and much, much more. So come join us.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.